Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why women become obsessed with true crime. We'll spend this hour with writer Rachel Monroe talking about women who spend years combing over the most minute details of horrific murders, sometimes to the detriment of their finances and their relationships. We'll talk about the kinds of victims whose cases are most likely to cultivate such fixations and the ones who are all but ignored by the culture. And we'll learn about how true crime obsessives relate to victims and to killers. Our conversation starts after a short break. When the Oxygen Network launched on cable in the year 2000, its programs were geared toward a female audience. Oprah After the Show, Tyra Banks, yoga and meditation, WNBA games. A few years ago, Oxygen experimented with four nights a week of true crime shows, and ratings were so good that it converted completely in 2017. Well, last year, Oxygen gained the most viewers of any entertainment channel on TV, and its primary audience has not changed. It seems that while men are more than three times as likely to be murdered and four times as likely to be arrested for violent crime as women, women have an enormous appetite for crime stories. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Rachel Monroe wanted to understand the particular fascination women have with terrifying true stories because she relates to it. Even as a child, she skipped over all the celebrity stuff in her mom's People magazine stash, but read and reread the chilling coverage of high-profile murders and kidnappings. Monroe's new book is called Savage Appetites: Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Rachel, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what was it about those stories in your mom's magazines that made them almost comforting to you? This is so interesting to me.
Well, I think on one level I was drawn to them because of the taboo. Certainly they felt like they were messages from adulthood telling me a story about adulthood that the adults in my life were keeping from me. Mm-hmm. But I knew I had a sense that there was something ominous out there in the world. But a lot of the true crime stories or even fictional crime stories that are out there in mainstream pop culture do have that odd kind of soothing impact to them. I think because they present us with a scary solution or a scary situation, and then they present a solution, right? Mm. If you capture the bad guy, then the terror is tamed. And so they stoke your anxiety and then they assuage it. And they often follow these familiar beats. And so I think that's part of what makes them feel oddly comforting, despite the material.
So you attended this conference known as CrimeCon. What is the atmosphere there?
CrimeCon was an overwhelming experience. I think for a long time in my life, I felt like my interest in crime stories was something that it did feel slightly taboo or something that I just wasn't supposed to talk about in polite company. And so going to CrimeCon, which was this fan convention hosted by the Oxygen Network, where everybody was obsessed with crime, was kind of disconcerting and overwhelming and in some ways really nice, feeling like I didn't have to be coy about these interests of mine, but also at the same time there was a blend of kind of entertainment and true crime that is part of what makes me queasy about the genre and part of what inspired me to write the book. This has always been an ambivalent interest of mine. And so there were things like, you know, the wine and crime happy hour. There was like a photograph where you could take a selfie as if it was a mugshot, or you could lie down in the chalk outline of a body and pose like that. And so there was a certain kind of lightheartedness that seemed sometimes ill-suited to the subject matter.
Yeah, I really appreciate that you sort of take this on throughout the book. And that's where I end up not so much liking true crime, because I can't help but remember that there's always an actual person who was a victim here.
Right. And I think that the times when true crime becomes more uncomfortable is when it is treated just as entertainment or as pure sensation, just something that makes like a scary story to tell in the dark or something, but then that neglect of remembering that there was somebody who was really hurt at the heart of this, and maybe many people, not just the victim, but all the family members and people close to them. And what must it be like to have the worst thing that happened in your life turn into entertainment content? I think that's certainly a strange thing. But then at the same time, you have lots of victims of crime or family members who want to get their stories out there, and so who welcome at least on one level the attention that comes from being part of this world. So it's not an easy line to draw.
Your first subject in the book was Frances Glessner Lee, who took the dollhouse craze for genteel ladies of her generation to a very unexpected place. So tell us about her.
She's a fascinating lady. She was born in the 19th century in this very wealthy family and was expected essentially to be a wife and a mother and a socialite. Her father did not approve of her going to college, so she didn't. And then in midlife, when she came into her inheritance, she was finally able to do what she wanted. And it turns out what she wanted to do was study crime, or specifically forensic science, which we all now know through shows like CSI as the scientific investigation of crime. But back then, this was still this brand new emerging science. And she just threw herself into it. And she was really influential in the field in many ways. She gets called the mother of forensic science. But she's best known for these dollhouses that you mentioned, which are, on the one hand, really cute in the way that dollhouses often are, very precise. You know, the little curtains are all hemmed. There's a tiny mouse trap in one of them that actually snaps shut. It was very important to her that everything be correct. But the thing that distinguishes these dollhouses is that they each have in them a dead body, a dead doll body. And they were meant to be used as training tools for police officers, because she was very concerned that police officers were not investigating crime scenes with scientific rigor, that they were just basing their decisions on their assumptions, their biases. And so each of these tiny little death scenes has clues embedded within it. If you look at it carefully, you can find out what happens. If you just observe them in a really surface way, you might make an assumption that a person died by suicide or had a drug overdose, maybe. But actually, if you observe these little models very closely, you'll find the clues that that's not what happened. So they were meant. She got upset when people called them dollhouses, because to her that made them sound like playthings, when in actuality she saw them as training tools.
How did she learn about the particular clues that a corpse might contain?
She became. She had a family friend who was the medical examiner in Boston at the time. And she and he would just hang out. He would let her sit in on autopsies with him. She was known for going in there and eating her lunch in the autopsy room, which shows you how desensitized
wow.
she got to it. She also became friends with police officers and would drive around with them in the squad cars. She listened to the police scanner. She had a little radio, and that's what she would listen to all day when she wasn't driving around with police officers. So she really embedded herself in this world. She became the first female police captain in New Hampshire, where she lived, which was largely an honorary recognition, but it shows how intensely woven she was into this world.
What were these called? The nutshells of unexplained
death? The nutshell
death?
Studies of, yes, exactly. Strange name.
It's strange, and it's so like weirdly cute and yet disturbing. I thought it was interesting. You mentioned that you've seen the Thorne miniature collection of tiny houses and rooms at the Art Institute of Chicago, and in its own way, you find that creepier because that is devoid of any kind of human presence.
Yeah, the Thorne ruins and Frances Glessner Lee and Narcissa Thorne were neighbors, actually. So it's funny to think about these two wealthy women in Chicago in the early 20th century. And Narcissa Thorne was also prevented from going to college. Her family didn't approve of it. So it's hard not to see them. These models that both of them made are different in a lot of ways and do a lot of things. But on one level, they do seem to be representative of a kind of shrunken or stunted ambition that wasn't allowed to flourish just because of the strictures of the time.
So one has to wonder if Frances Glessner-Lee had some traumatic incident in her life that caused her to be really hung up on murder. You looked really hard for this and couldn't find anything.
Yeah, I ended up really coming around on that question because that was something that preoccupied me, and it preoccupied other people who have written about her over the ages. This woman who, by all accounts, had this perfectly comfortable life, surely something had to happen to her for her to be drawn into this world of crime and to want to spend all her time thinking about and studying and observing dead bodies. And that's the message that we get from so many, at least of these fictional crime shows, that that the detectives who, particularly the female detectives who are drawn to these kinds of investigations, always have some traumatic backstory. They're trying to work through their own trauma. But when it comes to her life, it seemed like that was in some ways a mistaken assumption, and that maybe these fascinations don't always stem from a root of personal trauma. I mean, nobody has been able to find anything, at least as far as I know, in Frances Glessner-Lee's life that's kind of an originary wound of some kind. Maybe it's just this was something that interested her.
So the next person you write about is a woman named Elisa Statman, who in 1990 finds herself living in a bungalow on the grounds of the estate where the Manson family killed Sharon Tate and several other people. What did she know about the history of the place before she moved in?
Well, that's actually like a very contentious subject. She would say that she didn't know anything about it, that the house where Sharon Tate and several others were murdered by the Manson family was such a famous house after those terrible crimes that the owner actually changed the address so people would stop coming by and gawking at it. But Elisa Statman says that she knew nothing about the history when she moved into the house, but she quickly learned that it had this connection to this very famous crime.
So I guess it's understandable that someone would find out that they were living on the grounds of this place. Her little bungalow was interesting in that it was the place that the one person to have slept through the crimes was supposed to be all night, right?
Yeah, this bungalow was the subject of much fascination for many years. One of the things that was interesting to me about the Manson murders was, I mean, to be honest, I've always found Charles Manson himself pretty boring, but what fascinated me was the kind of after effects, the aftermath of those crimes, how they impacted the culture, when people talked about the Manson murders, they were in some ways talking about the 60s and the legacy of the 60s and what was too far and what was not far enough. And so how that played out in the decades that followed. And there sprung up this world of all these researchers and conspiracy theorists around the Manson family crimes who believed that the full story hadn't happened. And a lot of it does circle around that guest house. Was it possible that this young man who was the caretaker could have slept through these brutal crimes and, as he said, didn't hear anything?
I was really surprised to read that when there has been a murder somewhere that is high profile enough, it doesn't actually diminish the value of a property, it increases it.
Well, it goes back and forth. You know, there are somewhere the houses really, they don't sell, but then there's a certain notoriety that can come. I did just read that the house where Rosemary and Leno LaBianca were murdered by the Manson family the night after Sharon Tate and her friends were killed, that just sold for a pretty high amount. I don't remember the exact figure, but I think it's certainly above $1 million. Hmm. And so there is the notoriety can go in either direction, right? Can make things less valuable or somehow like be a form of prestige in a dark way.
My guest is writer Rachel Monroe. We're talking about her book, Savage Appetites, 4 True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with writer Rachel Monroe about her book Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. The Sharon Tate murder had a particular, I guess, public allure because she happened to also be famous and beautiful, and then she became a victim. What is it about that sort of combination of attributes that causes certain very violent crimes to sort of go down in history?
I do think that you see over and over again that the victims who become famous and become cultural icons do tend to follow a similar pattern in that they are beautiful, young, largely white women. I think that's because in some ways our culture certainly, that's a category of person that our culture pays a lot of attention to. For better or worse, I think that sometimes our cultural narratives about women involve violence if they step over the line or they're seen to have done something wrong, but also those are the category of people who we're conditioned to, as a culture, to see as most in need of protection or defense or something like that. And so those victims tend to get overrepresented in the culture. And somebody like Sharon Tate, who and she was also 8.5 months pregnant mm-hmm. when she was killed. So it's a really, really terrible story. In some ways is a key example of that kind of iconic victim, even if she is not necessarily, in many ways, not at all representative of who tends to be victimized in reality.
We have an email here from Penelope in Colleyville who says, it's related in a way. She says, this juxtaposition between cute and morbid, perhaps going back to the miniature rooms of the last segment, how does this genre fit into or push back against feminism? Is this thing about being cute with anger and violence, or is this about the idea that women can be interested in murder too?
I think it's super thorny and complicated. I think these stories are sometimes used in furtherance of feminism. If you can think about people like Anne Rule, who wrote was just famous for writing these true crime books starting in the 80s, I believe, and until her death recently, it was just a super bestseller. And in some ways, those books were popular, I think, because they allowed space for a conversation about domestic violence in a lot of cases. She was writing about these placid suburban homes where, in many cases, the husband was abusive. He might have seemed like a nice dentist, but actually that he was a violent man. And that conversation hadn't been happening as publicly until she was writing those books. And I think in some ways that's, you could talk about her success being driven by people, women in particular, wanting those conversations to happen. But at the same time, I think that these narratives are often used to justify political policies that maybe work against feminism. Like I write in the section about Sharon Tate and the Manson murders about the victims' rights movement and how that used the language of feminism. This is a movement that started in the 80s to further criminal justice policies that led to mass incarceration. And so it's hard to draw a neat line and say this genre is feminist or not feminist. I think it works in complicated ways.
The victims' rights movement so often traffics in the language of innocent victims, which is a really interesting pointed choice of words because it says not everyone who gets murdered somehow deserves society's compassion or concern.
Right. And again, we see this desire to draw lines and divide the world into an us and a them. And I think that is really an alarming legacy and maybe the negative thing to have come out of the victims' rights movement. You can look at things like there's some great reporting out of New Jersey about a victims' compensation fund that was meant to award money for things like funeral expenses or therapy to people who had been the victims of violent crimes. But they were so strict about who counted as you're saying, like an innocent victim, that much of that money didn't end up getting dispersed. So somebody who had a prior criminal conviction might not qualify for that money, even if it had nothing to do with the crime that happened against them. Or I believe there was a case where a young woman got into the car with a drunk driver and he crashed the car and she died. And that somehow counted as her being complicit in her own death. And I think that that desire to sort of draw a line or blame victims really does a disservice to all of us.
Okay. Elisa Statman became very interested in a crime that happened on the grounds of the house she was renting. You know, whether that was accidentally or deliberately, we can leave up in the air. But it went much further than that, her obsession. So tell us a little bit about how much more she really involved herself with Sharon Tate's family and with the case itself.
Sure. So she became... She began working with a man who was in this scene, as I was mentioning earlier, of people who wanted to research or maybe construct conspiracies around the Manson family murders. And with him, she went to go visit a retired LAPD detective who had essentially stolen, I believe, some photographs from the family. From the house, or he had just kept them after the investigation instead of returning them to the family. She then pocketed these photographs of Sharon Tate. They were photographs taken of Sharon Tate in the last week of her life, and then returned them to Sharon Tate's family. And then through this, became close with one of Sharon Tate's two remaining sisters, and they ended up, according to Elisa Statman, falling in love and becoming partners, and then moving into the house, Sharon Tate's family home where she and her sisters had been raised.
So was she after something more? Was Elisa Statman, was it just her good luck that she, you know, through this series of coincidences, she fell in love? Or was she looking for something?
You know, I certainly don't feel comfortable speculating about her motives. It's a deeply contentious subject within the family. And part of what I was exploring in that section, I think, was the ripple effects of a trauma, such as a violent crime, that it has on a family like Sharon Tate's family, who were just wounded by this crime in ways that persist to this day. And just fractured by it, really. And I mean, if you can imagine a crime that was not just so horrific in itself, but then became this pop cultural moment, and they had other people who were really fascinated by the crime, and you know, including a woman who insisted that she was the reincarnation of Sharon Tate, who would send Sharon's mother cards every Mother's Day and show up at the family house. People were just kind of, when an event is so famous and public like that, you get people who are drawn to it for their own reason. Something about it resonates with them. And so I think Sharon Tate's family had to deal with that for their entire life, this crime that was kind of symbolically important to other people. And so it's hard to say what anybody's motivations were, but certainly something that has torn the family apart.
Lori Davis is the next young woman in this book. She became obsessed with a guy named Damien Echols after seeing a documentary about the West Memphis Three. Remind us what that case was about that sent the West Memphis Three to prison.
Sure. So this was one of the final examples of the period that we know as the Satanic Panic, when there was a kind of a national preoccupation with the idea, later proven to be extremely false, that there were these satanic cults stalking America, sacrificing children. And in Arkansas in the late 1990s, three young boys were found killed in a really awful way. And three local teenagers were arrested for this crime. And there was really basically no physical evidence tying them to the scene, but the idea was that these three teenage boys were kind of like the local weirdos. They dressed in black, they listened to Metallica, and so the idea that was constructed by the prosecution was that they were the members of a satanic cult, and they had killed these boys as some sort of ritual sacrifice. And they ended up getting convicted. And Damien Eccles, the kind of most notorious of the three, was sentenced to death. And the crime became a rallying point. There were a number of documentaries made about it on HBO, and became a rallying point for a lot of people who felt themselves like maybe they had been misfits in their own town because of the music they listened to or the way they dressed. And they really resonated with the idea that somebody who, just because they seemed strange or out of step with their community, could essentially be railroaded and put on death row for something that they didn't do.
We had Damien Eccles on the show in 2012 after his memoir was published, and he remembered a lot of morbidly curious people writing to him about the crime he was convicted of.
I used to refer to them as rubberneckers. You know, like when you're driving down the highway and you see a car wreck somewhere, and people will slow down and do everything they can to try to gawk at, you know, the scene and see what's happened and what's going on. You do come across people like that every now and then that, you know, you can tell that when they're asking, you know, a question about the case, it's not like they're asking because they care. It's because it's out of some sense of morbid curiosity, I guess. Then you would also have other people, you know, as the years progressed, we became really close friends with people, you know, like Johnny Depp. He became like a brother to me over the years. And people hear about that, you know, they're drawn to it for that sort of celebrity air that started to surround things as time went on, that, you know, they really don't care, say, about the case. They just want to see what's going on over here, you know, almost like some sort of Hollywood gossip show.
He said it was very different when he heard from Laurie Davis the first time.
I mean, it was one of those things from the very first letter that I ever, we've been together for 17 years now. And the very first letter that I ever received from her, I knew this was someone completely and absolutely unlike anyone that I had ever come in contact with in my life before. And it was just so different and so amazing and magical that I instantly felt this need for more, you know, this insatiable desire of, I want more. I want to know what you think. I want to know what you feel about every single thing under the sun.
What led Laurie Davis, Rachel, to reach out to this person she'd never met before, with whom she had, it looks like, nothing in common except this sense that he was had been convicted unfairly?
Laurie Davis, she's such a fascinating person. She, at the time that she saw this documentary and became acquainted with this case, she was living in Brooklyn. I think it's very important for her. She stressed to me that it wasn't as though her life was sad or empty in any way. She was working as a landscape architect. She had a great career, a great social life. She was traveling the world. But she was also always a person who was very in tune with her impulses and really driven to follow her heart, for better or worse. And I think she was one of those people who was touched by this case because she also had grown up in the South, and well, in West Virginia in her case, and felt out of step with the community that she had grown up in. And something about that resonated with what she saw in Damien Eccles in that documentary. And so it was this strong sense of empathy and connection, and she followed that impulse and began writing to him. And it's, reading their letters is so fascinating. It's like a 19th century novel in some ways, because the whole love affair happens over letters, which doesn't get to happen anymore. And this, the sense of longing and obstacles, of course, in their case, the obstacles was that he was on death row. But it really is, there's something kind of magical about their love story.
How did she advocate for his release?
Well, I think at first both of them had a kind of naive faith that the justice system would work itself out, that this terrible mistake had happened, that he had been convicted, but it certainly couldn't stick because it was so wrong. Or that the lawyers would sort this out. And I think she saw over time that that just wasn't happening. The legal system has an interest in finality. It doesn't like to admit mistakes, I think, you know, understandably. So over the years, she realized that she was going to have to become more involved, that if she did not advocate for Damien and the other two young men who were convicted, nobody else might. And so that started with raising money, but it also it got to the point where she was essentially conducting an investigation along with some other folks. Like, she was going in and I mean, she told me the story of being in Arkansas, because she moved to Arkansas to be closer to him while he was in prison, and there was an alternate suspect, and she and this private investigator she was working with kind of staked out this guy's house and waited until he threw out his trash, and then they on trash day, and then they picked up the bag of trash and then took it home and went through it and trying to find, you know, cigarette butts or Coke cans or something that so they could get a sample of his DNA to test. So she was really doing this like on the ground detective work, also going to all of the hearings and pressing for legal strategy and just becoming a really crucial advocate for a person who otherwise might not have had anybody to advocate for him.
She spent $150,000 on phone calls.
Yeah, it's so expensive to call in prison. There are these private companies that that charge you exorbitant rates, and they just couldn't stand not talking to each other, and so it ended up costing quite a bit.
My guest is writer Rachel Monroe. We're talking about her book, Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd speaking with writer Rachel Monroe about her book Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Rachel, it's worth noting that the people who supported Lori Davis's work in working for the release of Damien and the two other young men who'd been accused in that crime in Memphis were overwhelmingly women. Why do you think women would be more eager than men in general to take on this kind of work?
That was a question that I asked of some of the people who founded the website that kind of coalesced around the West Memphis 3 case, which was one of the first websites around a big famous murder case. Now we see all these Reddit forums and podcasts, but back then in the late 90s, this was brand new. The founders told me their theory was that while there were many advocates for the West Memphis 3 who were men, the ones who really stuck with it were women. And, you know, I think that my speculation would be that, and in my experience, there's something about the long slog of a fight that fighting for justice really is, that there's something that makes women better suited to that, or at least that's how we have all been socialized to be now. And I don't know if it has to do with experiences of injustice that maybe many women have had in their own lives that make them resonate with other people who have been victims of systemic injustice. I think that could be one explanation. But I think that in this case and in many others, the people that you see being these kind of dogged advocates day in and day out are disproportionately women. And it's striking that it's something that is persistent over many of these cases.
For me, the most disturbing subject of the book was this young woman named Lindsay. Is it Suvanarath? Suvanarath?
Yes, I think so.
I had no idea there was a subculture of people who not only have followed all the details of the Columbine killings, but sort of express open admiration for the people who committed them.
Yeah, it's a troubling online world. I first started writing about them in 2012. This world, it's essentially an online fandom. But instead of being for, you know, Harry Potter or One Direction, it's for Columbine. And it was at that point, it was primarily young women going online, teenagers often talking about Columbine with the language of crushes. And it certainly is disturbing. But it seemed to me that we maybe did ourselves a disservice by stopping at the outrage. I wanted to think about, okay, well, what would these girls, why would they be doing this? They know that it's going to shock and horrify everybody. So what are they trying to say in this, in these kind of outrageous statements of love that they're making for these school shooters? And so it was a community that I found really fascinating and had been following for years when a number of years later I learned that a member of this community had, Lindsay Savannerath, had planned a mass shooting of her own.
You remind us that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, who committed the Columbine killings, intended to become famous. Did Lindsay Savannerath hope for that as well?
Yeah, it's really quite disturbing to read the chat logs, because she and the young man that she planned this massacre with, and the massacre didn't end up happening, but they had these extensive plans that they made over Facebook chat, and this has all been entered into evidence, so I could read, you know, thousands of pages of their chats, and very little of it is actually devoted to logistical planning. But the vast majority of is them, or not the vast majority, but a big chunk of it is them chatting about how they will become famous. They clearly seeing the idea of mass violence, of spectacular violence, as a way to get attention, to get a spotlight, to feel like they mattered. They were two young people who were really quite alienated, who felt they were both living at their parents' houses, unemployed, very few friends, and this seemed to both of them to be a way that they could gain some notoriety and have everybody listen to them. A world that had never listened to them before would suddenly turn a spotlight on them. And that to both of them seemed to be a large motivation for this violence that they were planning.
So the idea of this really chills me to the bone, and yet I realized a certain hypocrisy because I have eagerly read accounts of Bonnie and Clyde's exploits, but they feel like fiction because they happened long enough ago that I wasn't alive when they took place.
That's so interesting. Well, that was something I wondered about the Columbiners, too, that so many of them are these young girls, you know, 14-year-olds or something, and Columbine happened 20 years ago. And at this point, I think to young people, maybe it does seem, if not as distant as Bonnie and Clyde, it's at least somewhat almost mythological, the way that that story has been metabolized by our culture. It doesn't seem quite real. And I wonder if it is easier to kind of aestheticize or romanticize this violence that feels distant in some ways. And I also think, I mean, young people today are growing up in a world that is in schools that are so shaped by what happened at Columbine. It's not surprising to me in a way that it has wormed its way into some of their brains, and that they're reenacting it or acting it out or using that story in a way to say something about themselves.
Ironically, there have been so many high-profile mass shootings since Columbine that it's no longer like a ticket to instant fame to commit one.
Right.
People may or may not remember the names of the people who do these things.
Right. I mean, that was a sort of an alarming but interesting aspect of researching this particular part of the book, was thinking about how many mass shootings have been inspired by Columbine or attempted mass shootings. I write about a young man who was also involved in this community who shot a couple people at his school, which is in some ways typical. These didn't get any press outside of South Carolina where he lived, because he only, you know, quote unquote, only killed one person. And even the more spectacular violences that we see, I think we as the media have become better. We've learned the lesson from Columbine. I think we do bear some responsibility for turning those two boys into icons in a way. In the aftermath of that crime, which was so shocking and so horrifying, there was this response to sort of ask why and who are these boys and what was their motive and how did they do this? And I think that speculation, while understandable, did make them into celebrities after a fashion. And that is something that people like Lindsay are responding to. And I do think that we have learned our lesson in a better way. And you'll see in mass violence that has happened more recently, the killer's name will not be highlighted. And there's much more of an emphasis on the victims as an attempt to not create these kind of celebrity murderers in the way that we have in the past.
Our culture does sort of say, I mean, short of murder, of course, but we do say, especially to young women, whatever route you can take to being famous, it should be really important to you, right? And so we have 12-year-olds mm-hmm. trying to become YouTube and Instagram celebrities and influencers and, you know, parents who are making demo tapes for their 6-year-olds. I mean, I think women in particular in this country are given this message that by becoming well-known, you will somehow matter and exist in the world in a way that you can't if you're just like everybody else.
Right. And there's something that is intensified with the internet, I think, especially as young people spend more and more of their lives online. That becomes a space where if you're not known there, then somehow you're not really real. I thought about that a lot when I was researching Lindsay's case, how much of her life was online. I would say maybe in some ways like the majority of her life. Maybe her real life was the life that she lived online. It was difficult to sort out because online she presented herself as this very frightening figure, very attracted to violence, very dismissive of other people. And in real life, people who knew her said that she was quite meek, she was nice, she was sweet, she was just a small, kind of non-threatening seeming person. And so that was something that I wrestled with a lot in that chapter and thinking about, okay, well, what's the appropriate punishment legally for somebody who has fantasized about committing violence, maybe planned violence, but not actually done anything violent? Which was the real Lindsay? Was it the version of her who her parents knew as this quiet, shy young woman? Or was it this version of her online where she was just saying these incredibly horrifying things? And I'm not sure where I came down on that, but the more that the internet was crucial to her sense of self, then maybe that was the part of her that we should evaluate.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I think everybody at some level fears being murdered, even if it's not something we think about actively. But I think a lot of women fear being raped just as much. And it's interesting to me, and maybe it's just not what you looked at for this book, but I'm not aware of a subculture of women who obsessively track true sex crime.
That's a really good point. I think in some ways the famous serial killers, those are often, at least in the media, the portrayal, those are often like sex murders, but it's the murder that gets the attention. There's something maybe about sexual crimes that is difficult to glorify, to make into something spectacular, and that is a curious fact.
Do you think we should try to redirect the fascinations of people obsessed with crime, women in particular obsessed with crime, or is there something cathartic about it?
Well, I think that in some cases it really can be a crucial force to opening up conversations about violence, about vulnerability, about abuse, about things that don't necessarily have a space otherwise to be spoken about. And I think that in some ways the fact that women flock to these stories is a lesson that there maybe aren't other outlets for these conversations. But at the same time, I think that stories about other people's pain, I don't know, I guess there's a way that they can maybe turn us in and make us think about ourselves and our own pain, and then there's a way that they can kind of open us up to the world and make us think about how vulnerable other people are. And connect us with other people in a way. And so I would hope that the true crime stories that do that are the ones that I want to read and see and hear, that that teach me about the world, that teach me about vulnerable communities, that open me up to other people, and not ones that sort of close me down and just make me more afraid and make me want to lock my doors and stay inside and not talk to strangers.
It is unusual, but it also seems like obsession with true crime is a socially acceptable way for women to explore their darkness, since it's just not expected that we will act in violent ways.
Right. I mean, one thing that I was thinking about in considering this most recent true crime boom, which, you know, of course, these fascinations have been around for a long time, but there is something happening right now where interest in true crime is, for some people, like an identity. That it is in some ways maybe a reaction against another form of contemporary womanhood, which is, you know, doing yoga and eating yogurt bowls and being very like clean and healthy and interested in wellness and sort of perfect. And this is maybe a counterbalance to that. It's this allowance of darkness and flaw and just all the shadowy parts of our personalities that don't necessarily fit into that that glowy yoga life.
Rachel Monroe's new book is called Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Rachel, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. We hope that you'll use your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the Think podcast. And check out our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.